Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Eric Hirschberg. Hirschberg began writing songs in his youth, then later became CEO of Activision Blizzard, where he spent 8 years. He led the company through cultural touchstones such as Call of Duty and Guitar Hero, and then later returned to his love of music. He's worked with multi-Grammy Award-winning artist Aloe Black on releases such as I Love Not Drinking and For Real, and his latest single is More Is Not the Answer. That predicts a new album from him in the not-too-distant future. We spoke about his lifelong appreciation for songwriting, what led him to rededicate his life to music, and the optimism that both parenting and creative acts require. That's Eric Hirschberg on Into Music, coming up now. You always were interested in playing music. You had this, I don't know what you'd call it, detour or life kind of in the corporate world, etc., but also creative.
I love that I'm getting to the point now where that's being characterized as the detour, not this. That's some form of progress on the music, I would
have. And then what kind of led to the sort of like, I don't know, I guess exit through a revolving door back into music?
Well, first of all, great question. Let me correct you on one thing. It's not that I always had an interest in playing music. It's that I always have been playing music. I was a singer-songwriter from the time I was 15 years old. I had my first band in high school with my big brother, Glenn, and then after he graduated, I had my own band where I wrote all the songs. At first, my brother and I were both writing songs together. And then all through UCLA, I had a band that people used to come out and see at UCLA. And I continued with that band well into my 20s and well into the beginning of my working life, probably longer than was advisable from a career management standpoint. I'd started my career in advertising. But we still found time to rehearse, you know, a couple times a week and gig, you know, up and down the coast of Southern California. And, you know, when I was that age, I thought this was what I was supposed to be doing. And I loved it from then on. At a certain point, my corporate life took over and I stopped performing. And then when I became, there was a pivot for me in the middle of my career when I went from, in advertising, I was both a CEO, but also the chief creative officer. And when you're the chief creative officer, I think also having a band and being a musician is a little bit on brand. You want that person to be a highly creative person. If you're a client of the agency, you can sort of squint and see, connect the dots. But then when I got the opportunity to become the CEO of Activision, which is a, you know, I was an officer of a publicly traded company, running their biggest division, speaking on earnings calls every 12 weeks. Maybe this was all in my head, but I just wasn't comfortable being public as a musician in that role. I just felt like there were too many eyes on me, too many people, you know, too many big investors looking, you know, when you've got an earnings call every 12 weeks, no one wants to hear your love songs is what I, what I concluded. And, which I understand. So as I became more public as an executive, I became more private as a musician and as an artist until eventually it was just completely hidden from view. And there was a moment where a good friend of mine who I met at Activision Blizzard, and this is not just a work friend, this is someone who, you know, our wives are friends and our kids know each other. And, you know, like someone I feel really close to was at our house for a cocktail party and saw a guitar in the corner and said, "Oh, who plays guitar in the family?" And I had one of these moments where it was like, "Oh, wow, this is really, you really are leading a double life here, aren't you?" You know, I couldn't believe that I had never shared that part of myself with him. And that was a moment where I'm like, oh, wow, you're going to have to find a way to reintegrate yourself at some point. So I left Activision for a bunch of reasons, not just, you know, music was not the only reason for that. it was the right time for me to step down from CEO life for a whole bunch of reasons. My dad was sick. I was caring for him. My kids were growing up. You know, it was the right decision. But one of the first things I wanted to do when I sort of became a, you know, private citizen again, was to put out my music. And so I was terrified about it at first, you know, because when you become known in one lane in public life, I don't know, again, maybe this is all my head, but I just feel like no one's rooting for this to be good. You know, like I would have hated me. but again, like I said, when I say it's all in my head, you know, Mark Twain has this great quote, you wouldn't care what other people think about you if you knew how infrequently they did. When I put it out, I was ready for some huge backlash, you know, or some huge accusations of dilettantism. And those didn't come. You know, most people just were like, oh, he plays music too. That's cool. Anyway, back to my life, you know. And the music ultimately gets judged on its own merits. And I, you know, when I scroll through the comments when I post things or when, you know, from people who are following me in my music career, very few of them seem to know me as anything but a musician. So in this world we live in now, you can sort of be your symphony of selves in multiple lanes. It's been a wonderful addition to my life. It really was a deathbed regret in the making. I could feel it. I had a whole other plan to go out publicly under a band name. Some of my favorite artists are individuals who have a band name. You know, Sam Beam is Iron and Wine. And he might have some of the same players that have played with him on multiple albums, but it's him. You know, I perceive Bright Eyes to be Connor Oberst's, you know, project. So I thought, okay, let's create a separate Google search. You know, let's create a band name. And the name of my first album was Spare Room. That was originally my quote unquote band name. And my wife actually called me out and said, man, if you can't be your whole self in public right now, you know, when you're not answering to anybody, you're never going to be able to do it. And I thought about it, and I think she was right, and I'm glad I did it as Eric Hirschberg, and you know, that there are people who know me as that, and I still have my business life, even though it's, you know, I'm not in CEO land anymore. There are people who only know me as a business person, and there are people who know me as an artist, and that's cool. That was a long answer to your question.
No, I love it. It was just, you know, it just sort of got me thinking, though, you know, you're talking about going into these meetings and giving reports, and you don't want to, you know, mention being a musician. And it was like, on one hand, I'm like, oh, that's tough. On the other hand, I'm like, well, I guess if I go to the doctor, I don't want him at the end to say, hey, you know, come see me at Yuck Yucks. I do 15 minutes of stand-up.
Yeah. And like I said, when you are the creative chief at an agency making, you know, Super Bowl ads and making, you know, ads or little mini movies, you know, it's a highly creative business. So is video games, by the way. But I wasn't the chief creative officer of Activision. I was the chief executive officer. And it's a little bit of a different, you know, a little bit of a different level of pressure and a little bit of a different, you know, kind of outward image. So like I said, this all could have been in my head and maybe it all would have been fine, but that was the decision I made and felt right at the time. And this feels right at the time. And also this, I know it's odd because you associate putting out rock music with, you know, or pop music with being a young person's game, but it also feels like the music I'm writing is influenced by the life I've led and is influenced by a lot of the experiences that I've had. And, you know, this is just my own self-critique. I think the songs, particularly the lyrics, have gotten much better as I've aged. I seem to be someone who needed to live a lot of life to have something to say. When I go back and listen to this stuff that I was trying to get signed to a label with when I was in UCLA or when I was in my 20s, I'm very critical. Like I listen to some of the lyrics, I'm like, what did I think this was about? You know, I can't even remember what was in my mind. I described my lyrics back then as meaningful-ish. You know, they, I could feel that it was heartfelt, you know, whatever the emotions were, they were felt deeply. But, you know, anyway, I've gotten more specific, and a lot of my lyrics and a lot of the stories I'm telling are, you know, come from a lot of experience and a lot of laps around the track. So I think everything's happening as it should and in the timing that it should.
Well, that was, I guess, going to be my next question, because when I listen to the lyrics, a lot of what I hear is, you know, this sense of this thing
isn't worth my time. This is worth my time because this gives me meaning. And I was like, yeah, a 22-year-old probably wouldn't write that.
Well, I like that interpretation a lot. It's always a thrill to hear your work reflected back to you through someone else's eyes. So I like that interpretation. You would really like the song that's coming next if you like that theme. The song that's coming next is the title track of the album, which is called More Is Not the Answer. And it's very much on the theme of what really matters and, you know, what's worth investing in. And it was inspired by and came directly after we got evacuated from this house during the Palisades fires. And as we had this amazing, you know, couple of minutes between when we decided we need to go and when we left, and we packed two trunks worth of stuff. And there was a moment we were looking like, what do you take? There's a moment we were looking around the house going like, we didn't have that negotiated out in our minds ahead of time. It was an in the moment thing. And boy, was it illuminating. Whoa, was it illuminating what you grabbed and what you didn't even think about grabbing. And it's not necessarily the stuff you'd imagine. Certainly not the stuff you might have spent the most money on. That experience, that moment, actually, that 3 minutes or whatever it was, or 10 minutes, inspired this song. And a lot of thinking about that came out after that. And so, you know, yeah, that theme is laced throughout this album. And I think it is kind of a consistent theme that I've returned to a bunch of times. Some of my earlier songs, too.
If you think about it, was there like a specific moment, like a moment of clarity, something that just broke all of this loose in you?
I agree with you. That is something a 22-year-old, that would never occur to me, my 22-year-old self, to have that thought. It's something that you think a lot about as you age. And, you know, my first album, you know, had a song called Can't Find the Ocean, which was about my relationship to work. And, you know, it's funny, people who don't know me as a business person first hear that song and they often think it's about touring, which is way more romantic than, you know, business travel, which is what it's really about. But it's the same, you know, those touring songs, those road weary, world weary, you know, Can't Find the Ocean was all about, that's my anchor point here in Los Angeles. You know, I know which way I'm pointing by seeing the ocean. And I remember being on a plane and looking out the window, literally, I think we'd just taken off, and I couldn't remember, am I flying home right now or am I flying somewhere right now? Because I'd been in so many, I had this moment where I got a card in the mail from United Airlines, you know, the 7 million miler, or the 7 million mile club. That's a lot of miles. And they were saying, congratulations. And I'm like, I don't know if this is a congratulatory moment. This is a dubious honor at best. And I'd been in so many cities in a row, I couldn't remember, am I flying home or am I flying somewhere else? I can't remember. And I was looking for the ocean to anchor myself. Are we flying away from the Pacific or towards the Pacific? And I could, you know, it was land in all directions to the horizon. And, you know, that was that moment of dislocation that inspired that song. So it definitely comes with age, and you think about what matters, and you think about the relationships that matter, and you think about the things within yourself that you want to invest in. And, amplify, and the things within yourself that you want to move on from. So there's a lot of those themes.
It's interesting because I've talked to other musicians who have had a similar path, whether it was, you know, they were career military for a period of time, or, you know, they might have been in law enforcement in some cases, but music was always this tug.
Yeah. I always describe it as tugging at my shirt. I'm uncomfortable with it, but what I've heard other writers talk about being, you know, it channels through them. They don't sit down and write it. They are the way it gets from whatever world it's coming from into this world. I feel that. I've had that experience. And sometimes I've also had the opposite experience. Some of my songs come one note and one syllable at a time over months, and it feels like carving out of stone. It feels like very arduous and very time consuming and very much about follow through and intention. And then there are ones that come tumbling out in 30 minutes, like just born fully grown, and you don't know how that's happening, but it, you know, it's magic. When that happens, it's magic. It's one of the greatest feelings in the world. I just had this, I think will be the last song on this album, and I'm outing myself as a 20th century animal just by continually talking about albums, like as though those are a thing anymore. But, you know, I still care about albums and I care about what order the songs are in. And you know, when people buy it after it's all out on Spotify and Apple Music and everything, you can buy it on vinyl and then it's an album, you know. But I think this will probably be the last song on this album. But it came after my oldest son asked me, in a way that was not about his own personal preferences, but was about the world, you know, the state of the world, would you have kids in this day and age? And I immediately said yes, you know, but I said that such an important question, I want to gather my thoughts and come back to you with them. And the next morning, you know, I woke up and this song came tumbling out on that topic. Just no changes, every syllable in place, you know, just knew what I wanted to say. So yeah, I that's how it was always. And it, I think, you know, it's the difference between, to me, a hobby and this, is that hobbies you do when you have the time. This you do when it's time and it lets you know when it's time, you know, and whatever you're doing, you better be ready to capture it when the music and the ideas come. And so, you know, I think like a lot of musicians, I've developed a large, you know, web of ways of capturing ideas out on the road, you know, in the middle of the night, on planes, you know, just making sure you grab them when they float by.
I guess I never thought of them in the same way before you mentioned this song, but seems to me like parenting and the active creation, whether it's a painting or a short story or something, there's both an optimism at the core of them.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree. Well, and there's also a demand for your attention that you can't always give as much as you would want. Obviously, it's your, in either case, if you could, you know, call all the shots in your own life, it would be the first thing you'd want to give your attention to. But as we all know, other priorities and other things demand our time too. And so it becomes this thing you have to find a way to nurture in the face of a bunch of other demands on your time. And I always have. And, you know, in that period where I was more private as an artist, I was still equally engaged in writing and recording. You know, the output I kept waiting for it to degrade itself to sort of a hobby status, and it never did. You know, it just always kept tugging at my shirt and demanding my attention. So, you know, like I said, that's what made it clear to me that it was a deathbed regret in the making if I didn't, you know, give it its moment and, you know, just try to see if it could go out into the world and find an audience.
It's so funny because I remember as a, you know, I don't know, 19 or 20 year old, thinking that at some point, in some way, creativity was finite. Like, I'm going to wake up one day and be 50 and I'm not going to have any interest in writing short stories or, you know, it's just going to kind of be gone. I don't know what led me to that. And it just seems to me, I don't know, like, I feel like the older I get, the more creative I become in some ways.
Yeah. Arthur C. Brooks, he's the happiness guru. He's a Harvard professor and he's studied human happiness and human flourishing. And he's written several books on it. He talks about the difference between fluid intelligence, which is what he says we have when we're younger, and crystallized intelligence, which is what we gain when we're older. And he associates fluid intelligence with just like all the synapses firing and, you know, an idea a minute and, you know, this kind of like fluency with creation that feels almost irrepressible. And crystallized intelligence is wisdom and experience and pattern recognition and, you know, the thing that all the things that experience leads to advice and leads to, you know, lessons learned and things you regret or things you would change that you can maybe impart. And one interesting experience I'm having on this album in particular is that a lot of the musical hooks are ancient. A lot of them are things that I wrote decades ago that were stuck in crappy songs, you know, or that stuck in songs that I, some of those songs where I say, well, what were these lyrics even about? You know, either they had previously appeared in songs that I don't like anymore, or they had just been floating around my musical brain for a long time, looking for the right, you know, landing place. And then the lyrics are all kind of very current, very much thoughts and experiences I'm having, you know, now in this phase of life. Meaning there's no equivalent. There's no, oh, I've had this lyric hanging around for decades. There's none of that. But the guitar lick that the whole song is, you know, that's the foundation for the whole song is something that's been with me for a long time. And so in that way, I've thought about it. It's like, it's kind of a collaboration between my own fluid intelligence of youth and my own crystallized intelligence of age. My, you know, it's a little bit of a collaboration between my older and younger selves who had to wait a long time to meet inside these songs. And that's been super fascinating, you know, to watch. Now I can't imagine that musical idea paired with any other thought or any other, you know, theme. So it's like they had to wait a long time to come together.
Yeah. It's, I'm a big believer that some ideas, they have to travel that, you know, all those galaxies to find their place.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard not to be mystical about creativity. No matter what your other beliefs are, you know, music is magic. Creativity is magic. And I'm lucky. I had a wonderful corporate life, corporate career that I, you know, enjoyed and have no regrets about. And I think part of that is because I always worked in highly creative businesses, surrounded by other highly creative people, trying to make awesome stuff, you know, trying to make things great. And no matter what you're doing, whether it's commercial art or interactive entertainment or writing movies or architecture or, you know, fashion, the creative process is universal. And the obsession that it takes to make something great is universal. And so I've spent a life immersed in that energy. And I think that's what has always fueled me. And it prepared me well for this moment, because that's what it takes to, you know, make anything great musically as well.
You've been listening to a conversation with singer-songwriter Eric Hirschberg. You can learn more about him at erichirschbergmusic.com. You can also find his music on digital streaming platforms, including the recent single, More Is Not the Answer. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org. And find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torn Anderson.